Weatherly Report.
With Chris.
And Kyle.
A podcast about making music.
And life.
We still got to change the intro because we have to finish writing the podcast intro song.
Yeah, we can write it out until we actually release that. Then we have to change it.
I know. Plan probably about 7 more episodes.
Somewhere around there, yeah.
It'll probably take us that long to finish that damn song.
Yeah, if I never write some freaking lyrics to the damn thing.
I know. So I didn't leave you much room.
Yeah, for guitar, no. For lyrics, there's plenty.
Yeah.
I'm not worried about vocals and melody. There's lots of ways to go on that. I think my biggest problem on that song is making a choice.
I think that's one of the ones that we just need to sit down and jam to.
Yeah.
And you just grab some lyrics and just start singing.
That's part of what we're going to do after we record this podcast.
I know. We are all set up. We have a lot of stuff set up in the studio tonight.
Yeah. Well, we were planning for a different session tonight. That's not going to happen, and that's okay. Yeah. There's legit reasons for that. So we're going to focus on our music tonight instead of somebody else's, which is perfectly good.
Sounds good to me.
I'm all about it.
Yeah. So we haven't released one of these in a while.
No, it's been a minute.
We still love you.
Yeah, sorry. We've been busy.
Yeah, we played our first show as a full band, which was freaking awesome.
It was great.
I had so much fun.
We also determined some equipment things that we're going to change around for live because of that.
Yes.
Primarily... The biggest one for me is that I'm going to move over to my Bogner tube amp for live.
Yeah.
Just because there was too many disparate problems with really between the sound guy and my modeling head.
There's just so much gain coming out of that thing.
Well, there's so much gain and it doesn't have an individual level control. So if the sound guy doesn't have the gain staged correctly, and he's gain staged for running a dynamic mic in front of a guitar cab, then it's going to blow it out.
Yeah.
And with a 15-minute switchover, there's not a lot of time to fix those things for the sound guy.
Right.
When he's still focused on getting everything mic'd up and everything else. So if we were playing big stages and had like dedicated sound people and all of that, and more than 15 minutes to set our gear up, I would play the Yamaha head. Without a doubt.
Yeah, I have a little bit more time to kind of fine-tune it.
Yeah, but for local shows and doing multi-band local shows, the Bogner's just a better option.
Yeah.
So yeah, which was fun because I got to re-rig my pedal board.
Again.
Got to tear it all apart and go, oh, God. And then spend a long time putting it back together.
Every guitarist out there listening to this right now just got a hard-on thinking about reworking their pedal board.
I know.
I know I did.
Yeah. It's a thing, man. It's therapy sometimes. It's just – I'm just ripping Velcro. It's just
– Hell yeah.
But yeah, I got it re-rigged. Got everything. So I became a big fan of using my effects loop with the Yamaha to run all of my modulation, most of my modulation through.
What do you leave the phaser out, don't you?
I leave the phaser out.
You leave the phaser out.
And I'm an oddball. I like the phaser in front of my gain going into the front of the amp. So the first thing in my signal chain past my tuner is my phaser. And then all my dirt pedals, then it goes into the amp and then there's effects loop. At least that's the way it was run.
Yeah.
The Bogner's effects loop leaves a lot to be desired because of the way that it's run. And there's a lot of people out there on forums that pay money to have that effects loop switched out for one that's more functional for live playing and utilizing the effects loop.
Right.
But the Bogner also doesn't have a way for me to turn the effects loop on and off. It's just always on and has a blend knob in the back. So I'd still be doing the pedal tap dancing rather than pre-setting up my modulation and just turning my loop on and off like I was doing with the Yamaha. So because of that, I just abandoned the effects loop altogether and just everything's going straight in the front. What I may do to get back to the ease and limiting the tap dancing on the board is go back to a true bypass switcher that I can program. And that will give me the functionality. Granted, I'm not taking all those things. And truly, you get the signal path benefit, too, because you take everything out of the path that you're not using.
Right.
Which was part of the reason I liked using the effects loop. So getting used to everything going back in the front of the amp, still dialing in a few things, but definitely real happy with my tones, especially my clean tones, because you just can't beat the Bogner on those clean tones.
No, not at all. It's fucking crystal.
Yeah. So I'm really happy with that. And I've found the Bogner's internal gain channel that I wasn't a huge fan of originally seems to work better with my 335 than I anticipated.
Nice.
So I'm actually really digging that channel now. And I'm honestly not having to use a lot of my gain pedals. But still utilizing them some, and I still utilize them for the Tele and the Firebird. Mm-hmm. But it gives me a lot more options that way, which is great. Yeah.
I've gotten to the point to where I'm only using the Carticao warmer as a boost now.
Yeah.
I took the little purple boost pedal that I had on there. I took that off, and I'm just using the Carticao with low gain as a little bit of just a boost once I have my Blues Driver kicked on.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of the route that I'm going right now. I have my Mosky Klon clone. Mm-hmm.
Set I think up. Sounds nice.
It does.
It's set like up the Noble's the best, though.
It's set up as a boost, but it's set up as a boost that adds a bunch of gain coming in.
It just adds some girth.
Yeah, a little bit, but
makes it a little meaty.
I've gained it up even more than what you heard last time.
Yeah.
And ran the treble up a little bit so it cuts. So it doesn't necessarily drastically increase the volume the way it's set right now, but it increases the amount of gain. So it takes it from a low medium gain on the amp itself to a thicker crunch, essentially, nice. With a little bit more bite. So it just gets a little more aggressive, essentially. If I want a volume boost for soloing, I have the internal boost to the Bogner or any of my other dirt pedals, which are all set a little bit louder, essentially,
right.
Which interacts better with the clean channel when I want to use that. So I like it. It's fun. I'm still experimenting, getting it set exactly like I want. And I'm not going to know fully until we sit down and try and play through a set, essentially.
Yeah.
Till I make some adjustments on certain things.
I was extremely happy with my tone live and how it was projected.
Yeah. Your live sound was great.
I had no complaints whatsoever. Everything was controllable.
I was real happy with my acoustic tone.
Yeah.
I was happy with most of my electric tone except for New Story. Mm-hmm. And it was just because...
Well, it's a hard one anyway. We haven't figured out how we're working that song.
Yeah, we're going to do it differently next time for sure.
It just sounds so good when it's just two acoustic guitars. But it sounds great on the album.
Yeah.
It's just we need three other guitarists.
Yeah, we just need a lot of stuff. That or we need to fit, one of us needs to get a loop pedal and figure out how to incorporate that into the live performance.
How come when I suggested that like 3 months ago, you were like, no, veto?
Well,
you used the veto on that bitch.
You suggested that for acoustic performances to add to.
Well, if I'm going to do it live with a full band, I'm sure as hell going to do it acoustic.
That for me, the only time that works.
I'll just eliminate you, and I'll put it all in a loop.
Look, just go right ahead. You'll be Ed Sheeran.
But as we know...
I just see the disappointed look on his face when I said that.
But I have played it and sung it a couple times at open mic nights, and that's fucking hard.
Yeah.
I need you to sing it. I'll just do all the guitar parts with a loop, and you just stand there and look pretty.
I'm, you know, pretty and fat, but pretty. Okay. But, the loop pedal in the case of doing something live with the band, the only problem there is making sure tempo stays.
Right. Right. Then you get on the whole train of backing tracks, which we're...
Yeah, and I don't want to go to backing tracks. I'm okay with live performance loops if you're going to create them in the moment as part of the performance.
Yeah.
That's one thing. If you are, it's just pre-recorded and you're pressing play, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it's not something I prefer doing.
Well, that's something that both of us were equally trying to get away from as well.
Yeah. But for augmentation of our live sound for the full band, I'm totally for it.
Just be difficult to do because, like you said, the tempo is a huge issue. And then just ensuring balance and the transitions. Like there would still have to be a certain amount of guitar parts completely cut in order to deactivate the loop or activate the loop when we needed to.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be interesting to figure out.
Cause I mean, if I did it, I would want to do live looping. I would want to set the loop as we're playing, not just come in with a pre-recorded and just trigger it,
right.
Essentially.
Right. No, that's what I'm talking about. I'd want to do it live. And do it as part of the performance. Like you're sitting there playing the intro piece and you record it as you go. And that way now it just keeps playing.
Yeah, but it's not.
It changes. Right. So you're going to still have to make some compromises to
even
make it
when
work.
It comes back in the middle, in the bridge and the outro, it's still not the same. That's part of my composition. That's like my little thing is I'll write a song with three different parts. And then, but when you look at them closely, it's like nine different parts because I don't do them the same time every time I come back to them.
You're making them unloopable.
I make them unloopable. I'm an unloopable guitarist.
Oh, that's funny.
Speaking of being unloopable, man, the stuff that me and Taylor have been working on is so much fun. But my metal picking is so out of practice, it's not even funny.
Well, mine's non-existent, so I mean, we've established that. Like, every time I sit down to practice now, which I've gotten a much better routine going recently, and every guitarist goes through ebbs and flows of their practice schedule. I went through a pretty big low on practice schedule because I was just focused on mixing, mastering, vocals, and I just wasn't playing my guitar much.
While I was busy with my guitar in my hand for at least 2.5-3 hours a day.
Yeah, so I've gotten back to – I generally play for about half hour at lunchtime. Every day.
Must be nice, right?
Yeah, well, having a home office, and that's where I work, it's...
I'm going to start carrying my guitar around me and just pop up in the back of my fucking truck in the middle of D.C. Just start playing.
Get one of those little Yamahas over there.
Dude, I'll get a little Martin backpacker.
There you go. I've been doing that, and then almost every night, because now I'm in a writing mode... I'm doing a lot more playing guitar. I'm doing a lot more just playing, period, not only guitar. Like, I'm starting to work on not necessarily learning to play piano, but becoming at least proficient enough where I know what I'm playing when I'm playing it from a chord structure perspective and things like that.
I mean, it helps anytime you're going to be working in a studio or working on anything audio-related when you're dealing with MIDI. It helps to be able to have the basic tools for sitting down and plucking away on a piano.
Right. So working on that, I'm also working on building my skills in my MIDI programs with Arturia and the V Collection and some of the new Easy Drummer stuff. We just got a new Easy X today.
Dream Pop, baby.
Yeah, the Dream Pop Easy X. It's got some fun synthy elements and stuff in it and some nice electronic, dancey sort of elements in it, which are going to be fun for some of the artists we're working with. So I'm getting used to that as well. So a lot of my time has been spent experimenting, both on guitar, and a lot of my guitars I'm sitting there practicing as I'm messing with tone as well. Mm-hmm. But then just experimenting with instruments that aren't my primary instrument, essentially. Some piano stuff, some percussion stuff, some MIDI things. Sequencing of certain stuff. I've been playing with that. Learning how to automate sequencing within Reaper, which is a whole different topic we're going to go on to another day because it's not...
Yeah, I'm not doing all that.
It's an interesting path to take, but it's easier to do outside of Reaper than just import it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
Most of them are. I mean, that's what, like... Fruity Loops started out as just
Fruity Loops,
basic sequencer. Now they have DAW, DAW operations. But
the one that I didn't know existed, because it's funny, when you go on something like Sweetwater and you look up TuneTrack stuff, it's in with all the EZXs and expansions and MIDI libraries, but it's technically a totally different product, I think, that just uses the backbone of Easy Drummer to launch. It's something called BeatStation.
Oh, yeah.
Which essentially, from what I've seen so far, just looking at a couple of YouTube videos, you can import audio and slice it and do all sorts of different things to it. It's an audio manipulation. It's Fruity Loops, essentially, in a way. It does it slightly differently, but that looks like a cool tool that I'm going to look into as well, and that may be something else we add to the arsenal.
Yeah. I used something like that kind of back in the day. It was called Beatmaster.
But that sounds like a whole different thing.
But. Well, it was nice because I was able to rewire it into Cubase and just do the adjustments in the standalone program and have Cubase just automatically read it. But it did have, if I could take a stem or a stereo bounce or something from Cubase once I'm finished with that and just throw it right in into Beatmaster, and then I could just work in Beatmaster and not even have to worry about Cubase. You could render it from right there, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
That was back before I got into the actual principles of mixing and mastering,
yeah,
which doesn't really lend too much for that. But Sony SoundForge is where I would take it after that to do like what I thought was mastering back then. Wasn't even fucking close. It was more just turning it up loud enough until it turned red like once or twice.
Well, you know, the thing that makes me mad about some of the things that I chose not to learn when I should have is back when I was originally mixing and mastering stuff, my stepdad and I had T-Racks. We had tools to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't know how to use them. We were essentially using them to just turn it up louder.
Yeah.
That's all we were doing. We were doing nothing productive or musical with those tools at all back then.
Right.
But learned since then. The BeatStation thing's interesting because, number one, just because it runs the backbone of something I'm already familiar with. I don't know that it's as robust as being able to render within it. I'd have to look into that. I've only, like I said, watched a couple tutorial videos so far. But I think the ability to import audio in pretty much any format, because things, certain other audio splicing programs save things in proprietary formats. Like I think they call it like a Rex file or something like that.
Mm.
BeatStation doesn't. It's all just wave-based. You can import anything and export it as a wave and manipulate it however you want, and it doesn't save anything in a proprietary format, which helps ease of transportability. So that's attractive to me. But more than anything, I'm just trying to give myself as many tools as I can for songwriting for this album, because I have not been the most prolific at writing recently. And that's probably a nice way to say that. and I almost want to say I've gotten lazy with it, but I haven't, because I work at it every night.
Right.
I just haven't made much progress recently. Nothing that I'm happy with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think...
And that's not to say it's not fucking great writing. It's just... With me, with my guitar parts, it gets a little monotonous because we found this style that's comfortable for me and you to write in for mm-hmm. our music. And I just wound up kind of hitting a little bit of a plateau. It's helped that I'm doing more collaborations with artists and just having to step out of the box and kind of redefine how I'm playing the guitar at this very moment.
Yeah.
But then I'm able to kind of bring that back into my writing with Weatherly. And so, like, I've been on this creative kick over the last 3 months that it's just been – it's been a plateau that I have been just kind of coasting along for – probably the last year at mm-hmm. least. I mean, after even the stuff on the making of, we produced the hell out of it. We wrote that shit years ago, some of it decades ago.
Oh, yeah.
But we produced the hell out of it. But we didn't really do much writing for the first album.
No. I mean, a couple songs. Shoegaze. You
and
know.
Walk With Me, which we're not going to mention.
No.
Because that was just that was it's a good song. People like it.
We just needed another song for the album.
We just needed another song for the album.
And that was the one that was left.
Here's a fun guitar part. Let's just do this.
Yeah. Well, and that, oddly enough, speaking of that song was the start of me experimenting with the stuff that
with
I am
the
now.
The MIDI and the sequencing, yeah.
That was where that song started. Now, none of that stuff made the album. It's very much a song in the vein of everything else that we did on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Though it does have some MIDI bass and things like that in it, but you can't really tell that, because we produced the shit out of it, and it sounds like a P-bass.
Right.
But...
That was the purpose. We don't have a P-bass.
Exactly. It didn't have P-bass. Wanted to sound like a P-bass.
We'll make
one. But that was the start of this journey, and I've gotten back to it. And one of the things that I've been doing recently is studying songwriters.
Hmm.
Even if I don't necessarily love their music. And that'll take you back to the Ed Sheeran thing, because I watched a couple... documentary things about him behind the scenes of making his albums or writing certain songs or whatnot.
Right.
And just watching his process. But the thing about those that is cool is it's almost never just him in the room.
Right.
It's him and a producer or him and a couple songwriters that are working with him or whatever. So you get exposed to multiple people's style of writing and how they come up with things.
Yeah.
Within the case of one video. And the dude is a brilliant writer. I'm not going to take that away from him. Now, some of his stuff I just don't care for because I don't like the... The thing that throws me about his music most of the time is the rap section stuff that he does in his things. And it's a cool blending of formats. I'll give him that. It's just not something that I care to listen to. His more, unfortunately, more ballady stuff is the stuff that I will listen to of his and enjoy more. But it also opened me up to a couple other songwriters that he works with. There's this guy named Foy Varnes or something like that. I'd have to look it up again. Irish singer-songwriter. Never heard of him. Looked it up. He's got like 7 albums on iTunes worth of material, and all of it's interesting. So I'm going to be digging into his archive of stuff and just trying to grab some inspiration from prolific writers, guys that are writers. They may record their stuff. They may be artists as well, but primarily they write. Those are the guys that I've been looking into the most recently, just because it's given me ideas on how to approach things in the studio to spur my creativity a different direction, which hopefully will open things up so that we kind of move off that plateau a little bit. Obviously, we want to remain true to what Weatherly is as an artistic effort, but at the same time, I'm not above reinventing that in certain ways. If we can
There's a lot of elements from the first album that we could augment a little bit in the second album.
Yeah. And I'm okay even with taking some flyers on some weird stuff, like or stuff that's just not necessarily weird, but out of the box. Let's do something that's much heavier. Let's do something that's almost a cappella. Let's do, you know, whatever. I'm okay with all those things, traveling down those roads. I think it's going to be interesting to go down. I'm just trying to give myself all the tools so that when an idea strikes, I'm not going, oh, it'd be cool if. And then the idea dies on the floor and we never go back to it. I want to have all the stuff available to me so that I can quickly get going on any idea that we have or I have if I'm sitting here by myself and try and get it flushed out fast. That was part of what worked well with the first album is the newer stuff that got written for it was stuff that I had all the tools available to me. I mean, Shoegaze is a great example of it. I basically wrote 70% of the song, sent it to you. You added all the guitar, the pretty guitar stuff on top of everything, gave me a whole bunch of production notes and ideas on where we should transitions. We fixed a few of those things and the song was done. But the 70% of it was done inside of an hour and a half.
Yeah. As you were building an Easy Drummer file out to it as well.
Yeah. Like I wrote the first verse and chorus and then I sat down and started building out an Easy Drummer file. And then copy and pasted that verse and chorus down, wrote another verse and chorus for it, you know, sent that to you. That was the point where I videoed pieces of it and put it up, and then everybody was like, ah, you got to do that. But story we've told a bunch of times.
I know. I still tell it pretty regularly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's my favorite song on the album. I love the whole album, but Shoegaze is still my favorite song.
Shoegaze
and, like, Kyle sent this to me. He's like, I don't know if it's going to turn into a song, and I heard it, and I'm just like, I'm going to journey the fuck out of this song.
Yeah.
Neil Sean, let's hear some guitar splits at the end.
Yeah, exactly. So that's been my journey recently. I know yours has been collaborations and tone and
through composition.
Yeah,
that's
through
my
composition.
Main focus.
You're trying to get back to your composition.
Through composition. I have written way more orchestral things for other people's music than I have for our own.
Yep.
I'm starting to have a little bit of a resentment for that one.
Yeah, I can understand that. Trust me, there's something that I'm working on for that.
Yeah, good.
Not that it's representative of this song, but the way that I've been thinking of it is we need a bittersweet symphony. We need something along.
It's a good song.
Yeah.
One of the Oasis brothers collab on that one too?
I have no idea. That was the one that they got in trouble for copyright infringement for some thing from, I think, a Rolling Stones or Bowie or somebody. It was, I don't know. There was something about that song.
When stuff like that comes up, I just ignore it. Unless it's a blatant ripoff, let it go, man. There's no original ideas in music anymore.
Well,
it's all going to be a recreation of something else that's been done. There's millions of musicians out there dead and alive.
I don't necessarily want to go too far down that particular path because there's several instances. There's a recent lawsuit that it was against Katy Perry, I think. It was by a Christian artist.
Yeah, I saw that one.
And the judgment went against Katy Perry. Every songwriter on YouTube practically has issued a video stating they can't believe that the suit went. that way because it makes zero sense. Mm-hmm. If you go on YouTube and look at Mary Spender's YouTube channel, she does a really good breakdown in a very quick, like 6-minute video, easy to digest explanation of the lawsuit and why it's bad for songwriters.
There's a couple of them that are pretty good. The claims are semi-legitimate, I guess. I'm a little impartial with it, but the whole Stairway to Heaven lawsuit's been going on for ages.
Oh, yeah.
And they get down to, they're getting really in-depth with the compositional elements on what they're calling out as being the copyright infringement.
Well, my thing was, the thing they were suing Katy Perry for, really, what it boiled down to was almost basically a low-end pattern, like a kick and bass pattern. Mm-hmm. Number one, you could throw the patterns up next to each other, and they don't match. Are they derivative of each other? Sure.
Yeah, but they're both derivative of something else.
They're not in the same key. The songs are in totally separate keys. They're not an identical match. They're not the same tempo. How is that copyright infringement?
No.
I don't get that. So, and that's the basis of most people's argument against it. And not only that, if you play me a song and I can go, oh, that's the bass line from blah. Okay, maybe we have a conversation. But if it's an artist I've never even heard of, mm-hmm. that almost nobody had heard of, popularity shouldn't necessarily weigh into whether or not your creative rights have been infringed on, but it's sort of like the Fender lawsuit. If you can look at something and say, oh, that's a Tele, but it's not made by Fender and it's made by somebody else, then I get it. So, you got the Gibson lawsuit that's going on. Does it look like a Flying V?
Well, it's not even, it's the router pattern
exactly
of the cavities that looks like a Flying V.
Right. So, and that's the basis of that lawsuit as well. So if you can mistake one thing for something else, then sure, I can understand where your intellectual property has been infringed upon.
Yeah. It's like when you sent me an acoustic jazz riff that you were playing and I sent you a message back saying, yeah, dude, that's Certain Shade of Green. We can't do that.
Yeah, pretty much. It's it was a song I'd never heard of.
Pretty standard jazz chord progression.
Mine was offensively close to what they want. And I'd never even heard that song. So not consciously anyway.
It's just a good progression.
It may have been rattling around in the back of my brain from hearing it in the grocery store or something. Who knows? But yeah, so that's an interesting, it's an interesting conversation to have. And it's something I'm conscious of as I'm writing. I try to, if I immediately recognize something I'm doing as very, very derivative of something else, I'll take a turn and go a different path. But, you are, as a songwriter, one of the biggest questions people ask musicians, who are your influences? Well, why would I answer that question if only to get accused of ripping them off later?
Yeah.
That's the dumbest thing ever. I am influenced by other musicians. That's why I make music. If previous music didn't exist, I wouldn't be making it.
Right.
So I'm going to be influenced by those things. Everything I do is going to be a derivative of something I've heard.
Yeah.
So unless I'm directly ripping off your exact melody, almost in the form of parody, but not funny, then I get it. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, there's a lot of gray area and then there's, I don't care, So it's a hard topic, but it's the Katy Perry lawsuit kind of blew me away when I dug into it. And I didn't even know it was going on. Apparently been going on for years, but,
I'm sure there's thousands of them going on right now.
Oh, I'm sure.
Thousands upon thousands.
I'm sure. Ed Sheeran's been sued like 5 times for stuff.
And it's like, I always put it in the context of like Nostradamus. Like people are like, okay, Nostradamus, could see the future. He could predict the future based on whatever kind of algorithms he was doing in his head, whatever. The man literally made millions and millions of predictions. You're bound to hit on one of them. You write hundreds and hundreds of songs. Some of them are going to sound like other people's music. It's just, it's inevitable.
Yeah. No, I agree. The thing I'm trying to avoid, bringing it back to us, is rewriting the first album.
Yeah.
That's what I don't want to do. And I feel like we've made some good steps towards getting away from that with the first two singles.
Mm-hmm.
Carry On was probably the closest extension of the first album. But I think we made a lot of production steps on that one.
Yeah.
Then we took those production steps forward into Sea of Lunacy, which was a more aggressive song, a much more quickly put together. Like that was, we didn't spend a ton of time on that.
Mm-mm.
You know, we wrote it, got it laid out. You helped me arrange the thing the way it needed to be.
We pretty much mixed and mastered it as we recorded it.
Yeah, the mix.
I think we took like two passes of it after, and that was really it.
Yeah, the final mastering session was literally like, okay, we're done.
All right, right.
It was like 10 minutes. It was nothing.
Prop your feet up.
It was like, let's post it. That's basically what it was. You spent more time on the video thing for YouTube on it than we did mixing and mastering.
I hope y'all have seen that video. Even the promo. The promo was badass, and I released it like the week before Game of Thrones. I used a very like Celtic style, old English font.
Mm-hmm.
That was fun.
So
I tried to time that one right from a marketing standpoint. I think it did okay.
I think you did okay. You've been really focused on that too. Of
it's exhausting.
How do we take advantage of social media by posting things at the right times to get the right audience?
It's exhausting, man. Well, I have like 20 alarms set on my phone, and whole past week I've just ignored every single one of them.
Well, here's the thing that I
Facebook yelled at me and said, "Hey, we haven't heard from you in a while." I'm like, I'm fucking taking the week off. Okay, yeah, sorry, exactly. Facebook.
So I'm almost of the opinion that in order to keep up with that stuff today, outside of like an Instagram feed, which is very much, okay, here's what I'm doing right now kind of thing. Fine. I get that. That's something I can keep up with. Take a picture. I'll probably take a picture of us here in the studio tonight and throw it on Instagram doing stuff.
I don't have Instagram on my phone.
Yeah. You don't even have Instagram on your phone.
Nope. That's your job.
So
I got Facebook.
Yeah, I'll take care of that stuff. But with Twitter and Facebook and other things, the algorithms are making it harder and harder and harder to reach your target audience.
There's so many variables.
So to do it without paying a ton of money,
yeah,
you're kind
you just
of
gotta
short
have
luck.
The you gotta have the right network, and you gotta and your network has to have the right amount of support for each other.
Well, for me, it's honestly like if I'm going to start paying for promotion of any kind, I'm going to pay a person who knows what they're doing.
Right.
Who is a social media marketing expert, and I'm going to pay them to do it. We'll create the content. We hand it off to them. They set up the release schedule and figure everything out and figure out how to get it to the right audiences and what that should cost us. Because right now, if I tried to pay for advertising to get stuff out there, I don't know enough about what I'm doing to know if I'm actually spending my money wisely.
Yeah, definitely not.
So, you know, I don't want to go through it that way. I want to find somebody who knows what they're doing. And that's where I'm going to – when we get ready to actually release the second album, that's when we need to have conversations with people like Athena and Pop Riot. And
we'll be tagged at the bottom.
Yeah.
We don't talk about Pop Riot enough.
Yeah, I know. But that's the stuff that I want to capture better.
Yeah.
So that we get a real proper launch for the second album.
Yeah, agreed.
So that's one of those things where I've almost personally given up on all of them except for Instagram because it's just too hard to actually get your stuff in front of the people. Besides the people you're already friends with on your personal page, to get your music page out there, which Facebook views as a business.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the biggest problem is that because the Weatherly Facebook page is our business. We are Weatherly Productions, but yep. It also contains the band and contains the podcast. Well, there are certain applications that we do that would warrant boosting our post, like the Weatherly Report.
Yep.
I want people in China and people in Canada and Australia and South America. I want them listening to the Weatherly Report. I listen to podcasts from all over the world.
Yep.
But we start boosting posts for the Weatherly Report, then no one's seeing anything from Weatherly Band or Weatherly Productions in Baltimore because our posts are getting just scattered all over the country in random different little clusters.
Yeah.
Pretty much what they do.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I've noticed that they've done so far. Most of my marketing and stuff on Facebook has just been from just paying attention to the analysis that they give you.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Athena, you know, when does Athena post things? When does Kevin Hawk post things? I mean, Kevin Hawk posts things pretty much all the time and everyone fucking loves it because he's Kevin Hawk. It's Transcendent Events. Same with Athena. But there are other organizations that are like our size, that they post things at the proper time and with the proper amount of media around them in order to make some headroom for it.
Yeah.
Like Eli Lev. We haven't spoken about Eli on the podcast yet much. We've mentioned him a few times.
Just in context with Megan.
But we did some live recording for him at the barn at Hebron Homestead, him and Megan Lee, and they had just got back from being on tour. They went on tour. They were up in Chicago. They were in St. Louis. They were in tons of places and always seemed to have a pretty good following wherever they went. It was small, but it was consistent for them, which was a perfect Midwest tour for the duo. And just the way that he markets himself and the way that he markets his brand and at the certain times with the certain amount of media to go. I mean, one thing that I don't like doing is I don't like flooding with videos.
No.
If we're going to post a video, the next couple posts are going to be a different type of media. You know, maybe just a one sentence post or something like that. Just something to make it diverse enough that people aren't going to get sick of it.
Yep.
I hate just seeing video after video after video from posts. I'm like, give me some more content.
Well, I look at
some more
way.
Content.
I don't want to do the thing that makes me unfollow other pages.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because there's pages that I followed. I'm trying to think of a good example of this where there's certain things that I really wanted the information on and I want to see those in my newsfeed, but they started jamming up their page with other stuff, mm-hmm. you know, be it political commentary or whatever it was, stuff that just I didn't need in my feed.
Yeah.
But there wasn't a way to parse that. And the only way to get it out was to take the page out of my feed, essentially, to unfollow it. And it's a shame because there was certain things that I did like about that page, but the bad outweighed the good for me. So it's just avoiding doing that to people.
Right.
You know, other people in bands get it. Even if a band did that where they were blowing things up, I probably wouldn't unfollow them just because I understand why you're doing it.
Yeah.
But friends, family, etc., don't. And they might not care about every studio session and writing session that we're doing. They might want to know when we're playing. But that's really the biggest thing that they care about.
Right.
Well, that's the reason that I like posting those things from my personal page. When it's a Weatherly band thing that we're doing, I always put those things on my personal page as well.
Yeah, and that's another thing with making sure that your content gets out there is you look at your friends list and look at my friends list. 60% of them are the same.
Yes.
Maybe 50%. And you still have a lot of people back in like Georgia and
Tallahassee.
Yeah,
I do. I've got a lot of Georgia
that I don't. You know, and like all of my family is not friends with you on Facebook. But I'd say about 60% is probably the same. So if I post something from the Weatherly page and then 20 minutes later you post something, you share that from your page and then I share it from your page, you just flooded one single thread and then your post is gone.
Yeah.
It's done.
Yep.
So staggering shares is one thing, especially when we have guests on the podcast or releases with artists that we've been working with and doing collabs. I preach stagger, you know, share from the band page. Then a couple days later, maybe the next day, I like putting, you know, 2 days in between and then you can double up later and keep sharing them. And that way also when people go to your page and start scrolling through, they're not just going to scroll through and just see the same three posts in a row.
Right.
As soon as I see the second post in a row, I go get out of their page. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm going to see that probably every 5 or 6 posts.
Yeah. No, I agree. So it's just something to manage. But yeah, I think the big focus for us right now is on writing, both with other people and for our album. You know, that's going to be our focus tonight once we get done with this podcast. And, you know, we're not abandoning the Weatherly Report. There's a lot to do with it still. And we still will be talking to you guys all the time.
Yeah.
It's just, life got a little busy there for a minute. Because we stacked more stuff on top of everything we were already doing. which means something has to go to the wayside for a minute. And that's just the way life is.
Yeah.
But it's been a lot of fun. The full band thing is really, it's refreshing to get back to. It was a ton of fun. And working with your brother and Colin was a blast.
Being on stage, playing in a band with Nick for the first time in our lives. I mean, Nick started playing drums when he was 13.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have been 9, maybe 8, somewhere around there. I don't know. It was so goddamn long ago. We have both played in numerous bands over the years, and we have never played in a band together. We had never played a show together. I mean, house parties and shit like that growing up.
Well, you guys are just far apart enough in age where...
No, we had all the same friends. It was me and my 3 little brothers that all lived in the same house for 7 years with no parents. We all had the same friends. We all played with the same musicians.
Well... Then you have no goddamn excuse.
We have no excuse whatsoever. None. We have no excuse.
Well, I'm anxious to get, and this is really the next thing that, and I was going to talk to you about this off the mic. We'll talk about it here as well. The next writing session we have in here, I want to get Colin up here for sure, Nick as well, if he's available. You know, Nick's got a bunch of kids and all that. His availability is going to be a little more limited. But I want to start involving them just.
Yeah,
if they're going to be in the live band, you might as well be in the writing process.
Well, Nick's definitely eager to record.
Yeah,
he definitely wants to, which will be fun, and maybe we'll do that as some like bonus content.
Yeah,
at some point. But I wouldn't mind going back and retracking everything that we played live, and just retracking the bass and the drums on all of them.
Yeah,
if we have the time.
Yeah, I think that's one of those if we have the time kind of things. Yeah. Like,
I mean, Carry On and Sea of Lunacy, definitely.
Carry On and Sea of Lunacy, I can see some value in going ahead and doing, because if we're going to do live drums on the album, mm-hmm. we might as well go back and put live drums on those. That's going to come down
to talk about that.
Where we're going to record live drums.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So, here at Weatherly Productions, we try and make the Weatherly Report as informative as possible. We have both mentioned numerous times that we hate recording drums because it's a pain in the ass, and that's why we decided to use Easy Drummer and just got really good at editing Easy Drummer.
Yeah.
Recording live drums. Have we talked about the first Red Hot Chili Peppers album on the podcast?
You
I don't want to repeat myself.
Yeah, you did.
All right, go back and listen to the rest of them. Needless to say, Chad Smith's drums were in a basement that was surrounded by concrete, and they were only recorded with 3 mics, and there was a bookshelf in front of his drum set for some reason. No idea why. There was a mic on the other side of it.
Diffusion.
I guess. But yeah. The mic's on the other side, so it's grabbing reflection anyway.
Yeah, it's catching the room sound and none of the direct sound.
So you can take any room, and you can get a good drum mic sound, depending on what mics you use and what applications you use. For miking.
Yeah, it's a give and take. The better your room, the more leeway you have with your mic selection mm-hmm. and everything. The worse the room, the better you better be with your mic selection.
Yeah.
And the better you better be with your shelving and other things that you need to do to those mics
right.
to isolate where you can and do what you need to do.
I have noticed that for me personally, the better my room is, the less mics and the further away I can get away with using them.
Yes. And there's a whole debate you can go through on doing what they'll call a 3 or 4 drum mic technique
mm-hmm.
Versus isolated mics.
Yeah. Oh, dude, back in the day with After the Ends, the first time I recorded drums for one of my own albums, I had cups that I cut holes out and slid over top of my mics because all I had was instrument mics. I didn't have any drum mics at all.
Yeah.
So I just used cups, and it literally controlled a good amount of bleed.
It's the same principle.
Just kind of interrupted the pattern.
Same principle as the crash guards that they make now.
Yeah.
You know, I've done it a couple of ways. I don't have a crap ton of experience miking drums in the studio. I've done it a fair number of times. I've gotten good results. I've been happy with what I did, considering what I had to work with. But to do it right, I think there's a few things that we may have to invest in to be able to do it correctly.
Well, we need a good set of stereo overheads.
A good set of stereo overheads.
Definitely, because even if we're just doing a 3-mic technique, it'd still be good to have that option. Yep.
So basically, we need to go to 12-gauge and do a little
high 12-gauge.
Yes.
Your Omni is amazing. We use it on everything.
You know, the thing that I want, and this is coming off that Steve Albini video that we talked about. Now, we talked about this on a podcast that we're not releasing because the podcast ended up being garbage and we chucked it. But the Steve Albini method of putting a stereo condenser in, like,
over the shoulder miking too.
Well, that's the over the shoulder, but the stereo condenser in the front of the kit, like literally like 2 feet in front of the kit. And then the over the shoulder stereos, which you run out of phase to the stereo mic that's in front of the kit.
Right.
That thing I want to try.
Yeah.
And 12 gauge has a cool stereo mic that that's budget friendly, shall we say. But it's getting great reviews. And I'd like to try that one.
I'm sure it's getting great reviews. It's 12 gauge.
Yeah. 12 gauge
is
great.
They make a fantastic product.
I mean, anybody that can take a tiny electric condenser and stick it in the end of a shotgun shell and whatever else he has in there that I haven't taken apart to look at. It's a great sounding little mic.
I was incredibly happy with how well the acoustics turned out with pointing that at the 12th fret.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, with DI and a large diaphragm in front of it, but.
Yep, which the large diaphragm I'm swapping out for the ribbon these days.
Yeah.
But, they're a great company. So basically, we're going to have to make an investment with 12-gauge, get some other stuff that we need for the studio to be able to do it right.
Yeah, we definitely do.
We have a good set of drum mics.
Unless 12-gauge I'm happy with those. Wants to send us stuff.
Been down that road. great company. Great guys. I actually really, really enjoyed talking with Brad is the guy that owns the company. I had a couple email conversations with him over the years. Good dude. Really good dude. But he's a single entity builder. It's just him. So everyone that comes off the line, he has had on his bench, and he's the one that put together. Unless something's changed recently with them, but that's the way it was last time I talked to him. Also, they have a ribbon mic that's built into a 50-millimeter shell that I really want to. That one's probably on wish list. I don't necessarily need that, but
right.
it's out there. So, I mean, those are the big things. I'd like to get a set of boundary mics to use as well, but not necessary if you're doing stereo overheads. You don't have to go that route. I know Steve Albini does. He does just a couple dynamics, basically laying on the floor.
Right.
I would go with slightly different route, but the actual, like, the Crown or Shure or the, I think it's an Audio Technica boundary mics, I would go that route, only because I've seen that work in person. Chris Johnson, the drummer that I've showed you online, he's a drum teacher here in town. He drums with a couple cover bands here in town. When he records his drums, he does the Shure boundary mics, one on each side of the kit. And amazing results, and he doesn't run stereo overheads. It's just the boundary mics, and that's picking up all the cymbal wash, which is incredible because the amount of low-end roll-off he's probably having to do on those has got to be crazy.
Yeah.
But it works, and it sounds good. So I got to actually email him and ask a couple questions about his technique with doing that.
I mean, room treatment also would help, depending on where your bass traps are.
Yeah, well, and his studio is treated very well.
Those lows might be getting washed out already before they even get to the boundary mics.
They may be. And I don't know what kind of direct mics and all that he's using on his kit. I know he has everything individually mic'd, but, you know, that's a whole separate thing. But going down that route, the biggest problem I have is tracking drums in this space. Number one, I have a carpeted floor, which you shouldn't do with miking drums generally.
No, you can just put a sheet of plywood in front of the fucking drum set to get rid of that.
Well, I'd put a sheet of plywood under the drum set and then put a drum rug on it. Mm-hmm. The problem is really the carpet padding.
Yeah.
Because part of what you want for a lively, natural drum sound is the slap back off the floor to the roof, right? So you want it to diffuse up top, but bounce off the floor a bit. Well, you're not going to get that in here. Mm-hmm. I've got this room is fairly dead.
Yeah.
The way that it's set up, between the acoustic tile and the ceiling and carpeted floor and the treatment that I have, it's a fairly dead room, which allows it to be multi-purpose for what we're doing. But for drums, it's just not the right space, mm-hmm. which was the problem I ran into when I did the Screams and Whispers record, because I did it in a very similar space, though I did at least have a drywall ceiling in that basement versus the acoustic tile in this one. So I had a little bit livelier room in that basement, a little bit brighter, but still there was a deadness to the toms and the kick that I just didn't like. Mm-hmm. And it took me a lot of editing to get them where I was happy with them.
I mean, even so, you can only introduce so much before you really start deteriorating the sound on things.
Well, and I got to that point with the toms, and I ended up going to Drumagog and just replacing them.
Triggering them.
Because I couldn't get what I wanted, so I had to figure out a way to get around it.
Right.
Which I tried to avoid using Drumagog as much as I could. I've always sort of used Drumagog with live drums because I like layering the snare with a sample. I use the original, but I layer a sample underneath it just to augment it and get it girthier sounding.
I watched the thing of, there's a little thing with Travis Barker on, it started out with him talking about splice, and I think they used the beginning of that for like a little promo that they did with it. But he was talking about how on a lot of the albums that he does, a lot of the studio work that he does, he will write all of his stuff by just kind of by taking little segments of patterns that he would get off of splice and ones that he would generate in his own, because he's got his own freaking massive library. But he would always have the original pattern just kind of underlaid onto the new pattern as he records his drum tracks.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. And layering the drums is nothing I invented by any means. Everybody does it. But I've found that I particularly like it on snares when I'm doing live drums.
It helps you get the width and get the capacity of what the snare is, but without muddying. You know,
yeah.
It gives you a little bit more leeway to make something clear, give it a little more clarity.
What's funny is the version of Drumagog that I have, I don't even know how old it is. Or how behind it is. I don't even know what version Drumagog's on these days. Yeah. But it's also one that I've never found a reason to upgrade because the library in it's great. I've downloaded a ton of additional libraries for it over the years, and it works. And the triggering on it, the way that it functions, is very intuitive, and it's very quick. So I don't end up spending a lot of time. I just audition samples, find the one that I want, grab the threshold, watch the waveform, set it at the top of the waveform at the peaks, and then I'm done. And I'm out of the way. You know, setting up those samples takes me a total of a minute, maybe. And I'm happy with it, and then it's just leveling it. And you don't have to do any post-processing, and they've already been processed. They're perfect. Yeah. So it's ready to go out of the box. So that I'm comfortable with, and any challenges that we do have in miking drums, we'll be able to overcome utilizing that if we need to.
Well,
but I don't want to have to.
Yeah. No,
that's kind of the point.
I feel like using the way that a lot of Akon Digital's multiband dynamics and their dynamics are set up. I mean, they have their presets dedicated to just drum isolation and drum clarity and stuff like that are phenomenal. But you also have so much adjustment inside of those plugins.
Well, the other thing that I'm – number one, I have a ton more tools now than I did back then. The drummer compressor that we use on bass is going to be great as a general drum bus compressor. I probably, if I still had it and hadn't upgraded and lost it, essentially, the Waves SSL G-Bus compressor was the one I used to use. Because I don't have that one anymore, I'd probably go over to the Drummer for my drum bus. But I honestly think the Drummer may end up being a better choice in that case. The G-Bus works great as your master bus compressor. I was sort of forcing it into being used as the drum bus compressor.
Mm-hmm.
But the drummer's set up more for that.
I'd be interested in playing around with the H-Comp on it a little bit as a stereo compressor.
Well, especially being able to access the mid-side. Yeah.
Right?
Well, and running the parallel compression on there as well. That's going to be nice. So that's definitely one we'll play with. And a tool that I didn't have last time I did this. So there's a lot there to think about. It's just a matter of finding the right space. Now, fortunately, we do know another guy that has a studio here in town.
Yes.
Close by.
Yeah, I'll be reaching out to him soon. And we were starting to do some writing collabs.
Yeah, he is set up to record drums.
It's a nice space for drums.
Yeah, it's a good space for drums. It's well dampened, but it's open. It's big enough. I don't know about the diffusion in that space because I don't remember it well enough. I've only been there once. So I'd have to see that when I got back there.
Yeah, it was more directional than diffusion.
Yeah.
Vaulted ceiling, angled furniture.
Yeah. A good vaulted ceiling with open rafters is the best diffusion you can get in a drum room. Would love something like that.
Yeah.
But it's hard to come by sometimes.
I don't want to hang thick curtains kind of draped.
Between them?
Uh-huh.
Over the drum set as a cloud, yes. No. Out from it, no.
No. Just over.
But yeah, so a lot to do there. I think it's going to be an interesting challenge to undertake and just something to help make us better.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? So the topic of today's podcast has been tools.
Tools.
Get your tools, learn your tools, fine-tune your tools.
And hopefully we're going to have a song called Tools.
Not hopefully. It's already there. Why'd you have to spoil it? You had to spoil it.
I had to spoil it. It's not all there. It's 30% there.
Yeah. I had a flash of creativity at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke up and I'm going to use this now.
Well, and yours.
I think I got the idea now.
Yeah. Yours.
I let it set for a
takes
long
it
enough.
A totally different direction, which is good.
Yeah. I knew it was a bridge.
Yeah.
I knew it was a bridge. I heard it. I listened to it. I wrote to it. Like, this is a bridge. Now I just have to write the rest of the song around it.
Yep.
Yep. All right, man. Well, we should be back in 2 weeks.
Yes.
Don't.
Hopefully we get back on our regular schedule now. Not hopefully. We're back on our regular schedule now.
We got a lot going on.
Yep.
But we say this every time, and we do need, it is on the schedule now, but we will have some reviews coming out on All Things Weatherly at YouTube.
Yes.
You'll also be able to find them, allthingsweatherly.com. The website is live. It looks fantastic. The guy that made that website is a genius.
He's also an arrogant asshole, but you
that
know.
He is. That he is.
It is a great, number one, it's a great conduit to all of our other platforms.
Yes, it's simpler because we have the studio, we have the production company, we have the podcast, we have the band.
Yep.
This is way too much shit.
Yeah.
It's fun, though. I love it.
I do, too. It's a lot, but it's fun.
Yeah,
it's
man.
Nice chasing those. One big thing I wanted to say on this one is for anybody that is listening to this, if you have an idea of something you want to collaborate with us on, do not hesitate to reach out. It's one of the big things we're focused on right now. Besides writing our own album, one-off collaboration kind of things,
mm-hmm.
we would love to tackle. And for multiple reasons. There's a selfish side of it, too, because I'm looking for inspiration right now. I've just talked about that. And working with others is one of my biggest sources of inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, coming off the Anhedonia album, see Lunacy right after it. You know, I was in that grungier, heavier.
That was a fun album to write.
You know, it was a grungier, heavier feel to everything. It put me in that headspace, and that was the song that needed to be done then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Working with others is a big prompter for my creativity. So I'm hugely open to that, and anything that we can do to be mutually beneficial in that way, we're open to.
Mm-hmm.
So please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you need anything from us, mixing, mastering, live sound, any of that stuff, give us a call.
Absolutely. And always a special thanks to Kurt Main Strings, Pay Call Cables.
So, yeah, thanks everybody, and thanks to sponsors, and keep making music.
We're going to get to writing.
Absolutely.
Peace.